said so, but the young MacHughes might not remember that in the heat of their first real fight, and Ulysses's soldiers were likely not under any such prescription. His own horse was still standing where he'd left it, mirabile dictu. Phineas wasn't at all pleased to see his owner still moving, and when he clambered into the saddle, sopping wet, the horse tried to bite him in the leg. He snapped the reins smartly across Finn's nose, pulled the horse's head round, and turned back uphill, heading for the sounds of a fray. The storm had broken, and it was raining hard. He could barely make out the dark traces of a deer's trail that led upward. But then they burst out suddenly into a small, dark clearing, filled with layers of dead leaves, trampled into the mud by stamping horses. Some of the British soldiers had muskets, but the attackers were keeping them too busy to aim. For the most part. One gun went off with a phoom and a cloud of white smoke, and before he could see was anyone hurt by it, the ground in front of him moved. It bloody moved. Phineas had had enough, and when he kept the gelding from turning tail, the horse suddenly changed his mind and with a furious squeal charged the moving shape. An enormous black boar exploded from the leaves under which it had been sleeping, and all of the horses went mad. The sound of horses and men came faintly to me through the trees from the direction of the house. I was in the root cellar, turning over yams and checking for rot, but I dropped the yam I was holding and popped out of the cellar like a groundhog from its hole, listening hard. Not fighting. There were several men, but no screaming or sounds of violence. I slammed the cellar door and ran for the house, but slowed a bit when I heard Bluebell barking. Not her hysterical strangers bark, nor yet the view halloo version reserved for skunks, possums, raccoons, woodchucks, or anything else she might consider worth chasing. It was her delighted yap of welcome, and the dart of terror that had struck me in the cellar dissolved in relief. Probably no one was dead then. I trotted up the path, rubbing the dirt off my hands with my grubby gardening apron, and wondering how many men Jamie had brought with him and what in God's name I could feed them for supper. I also wondered whether Jamie had retrieved Lord George Germain's ruinous letter. I arrived just in time to say goodbye to the Lindsays, who were away home, they said. Kenny's wife would have something on for supper.
"The rest went on afore us,"
Murdo said, nodding vaguely toward the eastern side of the ridge. "We only came this way in case MacDougall should need a hand."
"A hand with what?" I wondered,
but didn't detain Murdo, who was already mounted and clearly anxious to be away. It was late afternoon, and the sky was still black and roiling overhead. I waved them farewell and went inside to see what or who Jamie had brought back.
Surely not Ulysses.
It wasn't. I heard him talking to someone in my surgery in a courteous way, and another man's reply, but not a man I knew. I twitched back the curtain. Maybe he'll be home long enough to build me a proper door one of these days. And stopped dead in surprise. It wasn't Ulysses, nor either of the soldiers who had accompanied him to the door. But plainly this was one of his soldiers, for the man was black and wore a wet British military uniform, though not one I'd ever seen before. Black breeches and a scarlet coat without decoration beyond the soldier knot insignia of a corporal, but sporting a stained white sash that ran from his shoulder across his chest, bearing the embroidered words, "Liberty to the slaves."
"Ah, there you are, Sassenach."
Jamie rose from my workbench stool. His clothes clung to him, obviously wet.
"I hoped you'd be back soon. May I have the pleasure to present to you Corporal Scipio Jackson of His Majesty's Company of Black Pioneers?"
He gestured to the man lying on the table.
"Dinna mind the courtesies, Corporal. I dinna want to have to pick you up again."
"Your most obedient servant, madam."
Sergeant Jackson didn't rise, but rolled heavily up on one elbow and bowed as deeply as possible to me, eyes wary. He had quite an odd accent. English, but with something softer mixed in. "How nice to meet you, Mr. Jackson," I said, looking him over. The reason for his immobility was obvious. His right leg was broken, and he was pale as suet. It was a nasty-looking compound fracture, with the jagged end of his tibia protruding through his woolen stocking. Someone had taken his boot off. "How long ago did this happen?" I asked Jamie, taking hold of the sergeant's ankle and feeling for the fibula just above the joint. There was bleeding from the torn flesh, but it was only oozing now. The stocking was soaked with blood, but it was rusty at the edges, not that fresh. Jamie glanced out the window. The clouds were beginning to part, and a sullen red glow lit their edges.
"Maybe 2 hours. I gave him whiskey," he added,
with a nod at the empty cup near the corporal's hand.
"For the shock, eh?" "I thank you, sir," the sergeant said. "It was most helpful."
He was grey as a ghost, and his face was slick with sweat, but he was awake and alert. His eyes fixed on my hands, one moving slowly up his shin, the other feeling his calf gently. His breath jerked as I touched a spot on his calf an inch or two below the level of the protruding tibia.
"Your fibula's fractured as well," I informed him. "Hand me those scissors, will you, Jamie? And give him another tot, but mixed half and half with water. How did this happen, Corporal?"
He didn't relax as I cut the stocking off. He was thin and rangy, and I could see the muscles in his leg clenched tight. But he took in a little more air and nodded thanks to Jamie for the fresh tot.
"Fell off my horse, madam," he said. "'Twas frightened by a pig."
I looked up at him, surprised at the hesitation. He saw my look, grimaced, and amplified his answer.
"A right big pig. Never have I seen one so big."
"'Twas," Jamie agreed. "Not the white sow herself, but one of her spawn for sure. A boar. It's in the smoke shed," he added, with a jerk of his head toward the back of the house. "No a wasted journey," he added.
His eyes were resting on Corporal Jackson's face, his own expression calm, but I could feel the calculation going on behind those eyes. I rather thought the corporal could, too. I hadn't started doing anything overtly painful to his leg, but the hand not holding the whiskey cup was clenched in a loose fist, and the wary look with which he'd greeted me hadn't changed by a hair. "Is Fanny in the house?" I said to Jamie. "I'll need help to set and bandage this leg."
"I'll help you, Sassanach,"
he said, rising and turning toward my cupboards.
"Tell me what you need."
I gave him a narrow look, and he looked straight back, calmly implacable. He wasn't leaving me alone with a man who was technically an enemy, no matter how incapacitated. I was torn between minor irritation and an undeniable sense of relief. It was the relief that bothered me. "Fine," I said shortly, and he smiled. Then I paused, a question striking me. "Jamie, will you come with me for a moment? You'll be all right here, Mr. Jackson. Don't move too much." Corporal Jackson lifted sketchy eyebrows at me, but nodded. I took Jamie back into the kitchen, closing the baize door that separated it from the front of the house. "What are you planning to do with him?" I asked bluntly. "I mean, is he your prisoner?" I'd been planning to set the leg, bandage it, and then do what was called in this time the Basra method, augmented by my own small innovations. In essence, light, though fragile, plaster of Paris-soaked bandages wound over a stocking and padding. Dry moss was all I had at the moment that would answer, but it worked well enough, that would immobilize the limb, but let the corporal move about with a cane and some care. But if Jamie needed him to be immobilized, I would just realign the bones, dress the wounds, and splint the limb.
"No," he said slowly, frowning in thought. "I can't easily keep him prisoner, and there's no purpose in it. I ken well enough what Ulysses means to do because he told me himself. Holding his man wouldn't have swayed him an inch."
"Will he come back for Mr. Jackson, do you think? I mean, he's a British Army officer now." Jamie looked at me for a moment, then smiled in wry realization.
"You still think they're honourable men, don't you, Sassanach, the British Army?
Well, some of them are, aren't they? I said, rather taken aback by this question. Lord John, his brother.
Mm-hmm.
It was a grudging acquiescence that stopped well short of full agreement.
Did I ever tell you what his grace did to me 20 years ago?
Actually, no, I don't think so. I wasn't surprised that he should still carry a grudge about it, whatever it was, but that could wait. As for the army in general, well, I suppose you have some small point. But I fought with the British Army, you know.
I do, he said, but...
Just listen. I lived with them. I fought with them. I mended them and nursed them and held them when they died. Just as I did when we fought... I had to stop and clear my throat. When we fought for the Stuarts, and... My voice faltered.
And what?
He stood very still, leaning on his fists on the kitchen table, eyes fixed on my face. And a good officer would never leave his men. The big room was silent save for the murmur of the fire and the bumping of the kettle about to boil. I closed my eyes thinking, Beecham, you idiot. Because he'd done that, abandoned his men at Monmouth in order to save my life. It didn't matter that the battle was over, the enemy in retreat, that there was no danger to the men at that point, that nearly all of them were militia on temporary enlistment, whose service would be legally up by the next day's dawn. Many had left already. But it didn't matter. He left his men.
Aye,
he said softly, and I opened my eyes. He straightened up slowly, stretching his back.
Well, and do you think Ulysses is that kind of officer? Will he come back for his corporal?
I don't know. I bit my lip. What will you do if he does? He looked down at the tabletop, frowning as though the scrubbed oak planks might be a scrying glass that would show him the future.
No, he said at last, and shook himself. Nay, he won't come himself, but he likely will send someone else. It won't come within my grasp, and me warned, but he'll not leave the man.
He thought for another moment and nodded to himself as much to me.
Can you mend him so that he can travel, Sassenach?
Yes, within limits. That's why I asked you.
Do that, then, if you will. When it's over, I'll talk to Corporal Jackson and make out what to do.
Jamie? He turned to go, but stopped and turned round to face me.
Aye?
You're honourable. I know it, and so do you. He smiled a little at that.
I try to be. But war's war, Sassenach. Honour only makes it a bit easier to live with yourself afterward.
I was more than a little perturbed by that,
and make out what to do.
But I wasn't personally equipped to do more than reduce Corporal Jackson's fracture, stop the bleeding, and relieve his pain, so far as possible. Right, I said to Jamie. I'm going to need you, though, for a few minutes. Someone's got to hold on to him while I pull his legs straight, and Fanny's nowhere near tall nor strong enough. Jamie looked less than enthused at this prospect, but followed me back to the surgery, where I explained things to the corporal. You haven't got to do a thing but lie still and relax as much as you can.
I will do my best, madam.
He was sweating and clammy, and his lips were nearly white. I hesitated for a moment, but then reached for my ether bottle. The possible strain on his heart versus the advantages of his leg being completely limp. No contest. I'm going to make you fall asleep, I said, showing him the wickerwork mask and the dropping bottle. I'll put this mask on your face, and then put a few drops of this liquid onto it. It smells a little odd, but if you just breathe normally, you'll go to sleep, and it won't hurt when I set your leg. The corporal looked more than dubious about this, but before he could protest, Jamie squeezed his shoulder.
If I'd wanted to kill you, I'd just have drowned you in the creek or shot you, he said, rather than lug you all the way uphill so my wife could poison you. Now, lie down.
He pressed Jackson's shoulders firmly down, and the man gave way reluctantly. His eyes above the mask were wild, glancing to and fro as though bidding a final farewell to his surroundings.
"It will be all right," I said, as reassuringly as possible.
He made a sudden urgent sound, and reaching up, took hold of the dangling small leather bag that had slipped out from its place between my breasts when I bent over him.
"What is this?"
he demanded, pushing the wicker mask aside with his other hand. He looked shocked.
"What is in it?"
To be honest, I don't know exactly," I said, and took it gingerly from his fingers. "It's, I suppose you'd call it a medicine bag. A sort of amulet? An Indian healer gave it to me some years ago, and once in a long while I add something to it. A stone, perhaps, or a bit of herb. But it didn't seem right to pour out what she'd put in." His look of shock had faded into one of intense interest, tinged with what looked like respect. He put out a tentative forefinger, and, raising one brow to ask my permission, touched the worn leather. And I felt it, a faint pulse that throbbed once against the palm of my hand. He saw me feel it, and his face changed. It was still grey with pain and cold and blood loss, but he was no longer scared of me, Jamie, or anything else.
"It is your Moko,"
he said softly, and nodded, certain.
"Moko," I said, not certain at all, but having some notion what he meant. Surely he hadn't said mojo.
"Yes." He nodded again and took a long, deep breath, his eyes still fixed on the bag.
"My great-grandmama, she is Gullah. She is a hoodoo." "I think you are one too, madam."
He turned his head abruptly to Jamie.
"Will you help me, sir? In my sack, a piece of red flannel cloth with a pin stuck through."
Jamie looked at me in question, but I nodded, and shaking his head, he went to pick up a ragged rucksack dumped in the corner of the room. In a moment he came back, a small red bundle in his hand. Jackson nodded his thanks, and rolling onto one elbow, carefully pulled the pin, unfolded the cloth, and stirred the contents with a careful forefinger. A moment later he picked something from the rubble of stones and feathers and seeds, dried leaves and scraps of wood and iron, and beckoned to me to put my hand out, then deposited something dark and hard in my palm.
"This is Haijon the Conqueror," he said. "My great-grandmama gives him to me, and says to me, it is man's medicine, and will heal me if I am hurt or sick. You put this into your moko before you put your hands on me, please."
It was a dried modular root, so dark a brown as to be almost black, but a very peculiar one. I could see why his great-grandmother said it was man's medicine, though. It looked exactly like a tiny pair of testicles.
"Thank you," I said, rubbing my thumb over the object.
It felt like a well-polished bit of hard root, but I wasn't feeling any particular sense of anything from it.
"Your great-grandmother is a hoodoo? Would that be a sort of healer?"
He nodded, though his mouth shifted sideways, slightly dubious.
"Mostly, madam."
Jamie cleared his throat in a meaningful sort of way. He was standing near the fire, and small wisps of steam were rising from his hair and clothes. "Well, then." I tucked the bit of root into my amulet, cleared my throat, and picked up the mask again. "Lie down, Mr. Jackson. This won't take a moment." It did, of course, take somewhat longer than that, but the look of amazement on Corporal Jackson's face when he blinked and opened his eyes to see his legs straightened, bandaged, and wrapped in drying strips of linen soaked in a mixture of gypsum, lime, and water was very gratifying.
"How?"
he said, and added something in a language I didn't recognize, almost to himself. "You might feel a little dizzy," I said, smiling at him. "Just close your eyes and rest for a bit. The plaster on your leg needs to dry before we can move you." I eased a folded towel under his head and covered him with my trusty surgery blanket. "I'll send you something warm to drink that will help the pain," I told him, tucking the blanket round his shoulders, "and I'll be back to check on you soon." Fanny was in the kitchen, chopping bacon into small bits, watched closely by Bluebell, but she amiably stopped doing this in order to make Mr. Jackson a posset. "Warm milk with an egg beaten up in it, if we have any eggs."
"Yes'm, there are," she said proudly. "I found 3 this morning. But I think they might be duck eggs," she added dubiously. "'Twas near the creek, and they're somewhat bigger than your Scotch dumpies lay."
"So much the better, as long as they're moderately fresh," I said. "If there's an embryo, you know, the beginning of a duck, in the egg, just lift it out and give it to Bluebell. It won't hurt the posset." "Not that Corporal Jackson is likely to notice," I added reflectively, "once you've added 2 jiggers of whiskey and a spoonful of sugar. I think he'll fall asleep right away. If he doesn't, though, you can give him 1 spoonful of the laudanum." I left her with instructions to come fetch me if the corporal seemed feverish or disturbed in any way, and went upstairs to take care of my 2nd patient. Jamie was sitting on the bed, naked, rubbing his loosened wet hair with a towel. I came to him, took the towel, kissed him on the back of the neck, and took over the toweling, massaging his scalp. He sighed and let his shoulders slump in relief. He wasn't shivering, but he was cold. Too cold even for goosebumps. His flesh had a smooth, nacreous look and was damp and chilly to the touch. "You look like the inside of an oyster shell," I said, rubbing my hands together to generate some warmth before applying them to his shoulders. "Let's try a little friction." He made a small sound of amusement and leaned forward, stretching his back in invitation.
"If you thought I looked like an oyster, I'd worry," he said. "Oh, God, that feels good. How's your man, then?"
"I think he'll be fine, as long as he can be kept off the leg for a few weeks. Complex fracture is always a touchy thing because of the chance of infection or displacement, but the break itself was relatively clean." I caught sight of his discarded clothes. His greatcoat lay on the floor in a sopping pile, oozing water, and his hunting shirt, buckskin breeches, and woolen stockings lay in a smaller, wet pile beside it. "What on earth did you do?" I asked, continuing to rub his back, but more slowly. "Fall into the water?"
I did," he said,
in a tone of voice indicating that he didn't want to talk about it. "So he hasn't got the letter." It made me look more closely at him, though, and now, with his hair pulled back, I noticed that his left ear was bright red and swollen when I got a closer look at it. "The boar?" I asked, touching it gingerly.
"Ulysses,"
he said tersely, moving his head away from my touch.
"Indeed. What else?"
"A horse kicked me," he said reluctantly. "As nothing, Sassenach."
"Ha!" I said, taking my hands off him. "I've heard that one before. Show me." He made a disgruntled noise, but leaned to the side and moved his arm. There was a fresh, pale blue bruise that ran from his hip down the side of his leg for 8 inches or so. I prodded it, eliciting a few more disgruntled noises, but so far as I could tell, no bones were broken.
"I told you," he said. "Can I lie down now?"
He didn't wait for permission, but stretched out on the bed with a luxurious groan, flexed his toes, and closed his eyes.
"You maybe want to finish drying me off?"
One eye cracked open.
"A wee bit of friction wouldn't have come amiss."
"And what if Fanny comes up while I'm applying this friction to say Mr. Jackson's dying?"
"Could you save him if he was?"
One hand was idly combing through the damp reddish-blonde bush of his pubic hair, in case I'd missed his point, which I hadn't. "Probably not, unless he was choking on the posset."
"Well, he'll have finished the posset long before you reach the point of no return here."
"He told me long ago that fighting gave one, a male one, I assumed, a terrible cockstand, assuming you weren't too badly wounded. I suppose this desire for friction should be reassuring." I sat down beside him and took a thoughtful grasp of the point in question. It was also cold, blanched, and shrunken, but seemed to be thawing rapidly in my hand.
"It would help me think," he suggested.
I don't believe men think at all in such circumstances, I said, but began to apply a very tentative sort of friction. His body hair had dried and begun to rise in its usual exuberant fuzz.
Of course we think, he said,
closing his eyes again. An expectant look was beginning to bloom on his face. I definitely got his circulation restarted.
About what exactly?
I lay down beside him and nuzzled his shoulder, not letting go. A large, cold hand rose up the back of my thigh, pushed under petticoat and shift, and grasped my bottom with intent. I gasped, but didn't quite shriek.
That, he said with satisfaction. Would you maybe like to be on top, Sassenach? Or maybe bent over a pillow? For the view?
I wasn't sure whether the adrenaline of battle just didn't diffuse immediately, the recent nearness of death inducing a strong need to reproduce, or whether the desire for sex merely expressed a need to reassure oneself that one was still alive and in reasonable working order. Regardless, I had to admit that it had a settling effect. I shook and patted myself back into some sort of order, looked at my reflection in the glass, then shook my head and wound my hair up into a makeshift bun, precariously fastened by a couple of quills stolen from Jamie's desk as I passed the study. I could hear voices in the kitchen, and one of them was Ian's, which lifted my heart. He and Totus were sitting at the table, eating bread and honey, conversing with Fanny and Agnes in a mélange of languages. I recognized English, Gaelic, and what I assumed to be Mohawk, plus a few words of French, and a certain amount of sign language regarding food. So there you are, I said, not quite accusingly.
Here we are, Ian agreed amiably. I hear you've a visitor, Auntie.
We've had more than one, I replied, and sat down, suddenly aware that it had been many hours since I'd eaten anything. Did the girls tell you?
They've told me about the black soldiers, he said, smiling at the girls, and the man whose leg you've sawed off. But I dare say you ken a bit more about what's happened, Auntie.
I do. I reached for a slice of bread and the honey pot and filled him in. His eyes went round when I told him about the reappearance of Ulysses, whom he knew, but hadn't seen since that worthy's departure from River Run years before. The same eyes narrowed when I told him just what Ulysses had said.
Aye, he said, when I'd finished my tale. What does Uncle Jimmy mean to do about it?
He hasn't told me yet, I said uneasily, but he didn't take out after the man. I mean, he could have followed Ulysses after the fight and left someone else to bring Corporal Jackson back here, but he didn't. Ian lifted a shoulder, dismissing this.
Well, he doesn't really need to chase him, does he? You say Ulysses has a good-sized band of men? Anyone could track a group like that, especially with the ground like it is.
He bent and lifted Totus's foot up high to display the coating of mud that covered the boy's moccasin and fringed the edge of his leggings.
And Uncle Jimmy's got a prisoner, he added,
putting down the foot and ruffling Totus's hair, which made the boy giggle.
No point in chasing Ulysses without the militia, and it would take half a day to gather Uncle Jamie's men.
I'm sure he wouldn't do that, I said, pouring a cup of milk. The last thing he'd want is a pitched battle that might get men killed on either side, let alone kill soldiers and bring down the wrath, well, more wrath, of the British army.
Aye, that would cause talk, Ian said thoughtfully, and the fewer folk who ken about that letter, the better.
Jesus, I hadn't even thought about that, I said. The bread and honey was restoring my depleted blood glucose, and I was beginning to be able to think coherently. For the contents of that letter to become widely known, and thus known to loyalists not only on the ridge, but from the nearby back country, would be disastrous. They'd like nothing better than to rally a so-called committee of safety, cover for anything from blackmail to brigandage, and come arrest the Fraser of Fraser's Ridge. Or burn his new illicit house over his head, as Ulysses had threatened.
King Beaver, forsooth, I muttered under my breath.
"Uncle Jimmy is not damaged," Ian said, an expression that couldn't quite be called a smirk on his face as he looked me over.
"He's asleep," I said, ignoring the undertones. "Would you like some apple and raisin pie, Totis?" Totis was normally a rather solemn little boy, but at this suggestion he grinned hugely, displaying the gap where a late baby tooth had recently fallen out.
"Yes, please, Great Auntie Witch," he said.
Fanny giggled. "Great Auntie Witch," I said, giving Ian an eye as I got up to fetch the pie. He shrugged.
"Well, the sachem calls you."
The sachem lived by himself in a small dwelling he'd built that looked like part of the forest, but I gathered that he spent a great deal of time with the Murrays. The sachem was one thing, the inhabitants of the ridge were something else. I couldn't stop the more suspicious-minded tenants thinking or saying that I was a witch, but it was another thing to have my own great-nephew saying so in public. I said to Totis. "Perhaps you could call me by the Mohawk name for witch." He frowned at me, puzzled. Ian, with a slightly odd look on his face, bent down and whispered something in the boy's ear. Both of them then looked at me, Totis in awe and Ian with circumspection.
"I dinna think so, Auntie," he said. "There is a Mohawk word for it, but it's a word that means you have powers without saying quite what kind of powers."
"Oh, well, just Great Auntie, then, please." I smiled at Totis, who returned the smile, but with an expression of caution.
"Aye, that'll do fine."
Ian got up and brushed crumbs off his buckskins.
"Tell Uncle Jimmy I've gone to have a wee kick at Ulysses. I want to make sure he's really got off the mountain and isn't a-lurking about. And I want to ken which way he's going, so as we can find him when we want him."
Chapter 132. Man's Medicine. The house began to breathe again as things eased gradually through the evening. Ian hadn't returned, but I'd sent Jem and Totis up to tell Rachel where he'd gone, and both boys returned for supper. The weather cleared and warmed, and a wonderful sunset spread a blazing curtain of bright gold cloud in the western sky. Everyone went to sit on the porch and enjoy it, and I told Jamie, who'd come down to eat, where Ian was. He'd paused for a moment, brow furrowed, but then nodded and relaxed, taking my hand. The vibration of Ulysses's visitation was still with us, but beginning to fade, though the presence of Corporal Scipio Jackson in my surgery was an uneasy reminder. I organized the four older girls into shifts to sit with Corporal Jackson and administer food if wanted, honey water, whether wanted or not, and laudanum if needed. Then I fumbled my way upstairs, my eyes already closing, and fell asleep with no memory of undressing. When I woke, somewhere past midnight, I discovered that this was because I hadn't undressed at all, but merely collapsed onto the bed. Jamie was sleeping deeply and didn't stir when I got up and went down to relieve the watch and check on my patient. Agnes was dozing in my rocking chair, but stirred and rose groggily when I came into the surgery. I put a finger to my lips and waved her back. Her knees folded at once. She was asleep again almost before her bottom hit the cushion. The chair rocked gently back under her weight. She was visibly pregnant by now. Then came to rest. The only light came from the smothered embers in the tiny brazier on the counter, but the diffuse glow made the surgery seem soft and dreamlike, glimmering among the bottles, hazy among the hanging herbs drying overhead. Corporal Jackson was asleep now, too. I'd looked in twice before going to bed, and finding him the last time wakeful, feverish, and in what hospital personnel tactfully call discomfort, had given him a tea of willow bark and valerian with a few drops of laudanum. His face was slack and calm, mouth a little open, breathing with a slight congestive sound. I put both hands gently on his leg, one below the plaster dressing, a thumb on the pulse in his ankle, and the other on his thigh. His flesh was still noticeably warm, but not alarmingly so. I could feel the pulse of his femoral artery, slow and strong, and felt my own pulse in the fingertips of the hand on his ankle. I stood still, breathing slowly, and felt the pulses equalize between my hands. The slow beat of the mingled pulses made me think suddenly of Roger's throat and of Brianna's heart, and then of William. So she'd met her brother at last. That thought made me smile, and at the same time experience a deep pang of regret. I'd have given a great deal to see that meeting. From John's carefully composed letter, it had been clear that that meeting was what he really wanted. Not that he wouldn't want to help Bree to a fat commission, or have her there for the sake of her own company, but I recognized the commission as being merely the shimmering fly on the surface of his pond. Jamie, who probably knew John a lot better than I did, quite clearly saw that too. And yet he'd simply picked up the baited hook, examined it, and then deliberately swallowed it. Yes, he'd needed guns urgently. Yes, he wanted to restore Germain to his parents. To some extent, he probably also wanted Roger to be ordained. But I knew what he wanted most, and knew that John wanted it just as badly. They wanted William to be happy. Clearly, neither one was in a position to help William come to terms with the fact that they both lied to him, let alone help him pick up the pieces of his identity. Nobody could do that but William. But Brianna was a part of his identity, and possibly something for him to hang on to while he fitted the rest of his life together. Even more than I would have wanted to see the meeting between William and Bree, each knowing who the other was. I longed to see Jamie's face watching such a meeting. I shook my head and let the vision fade, listening to Corporal Jackson's body and the whisper of sand through the hourglass. Agnes and Fanny were meant to change places every 2 hours, but neither one could stay awake that long. Letting the peace of the night surgery flow into me, and from me, with luck, into the young man under my hands. I thought him older when I first saw him, but with the lines of tension, fear, and pain smoothed out of his face, it was clear that he wasn't more than 25. Moved by an impulse, I let go of his leg and fetched my medicine bag amulet from the cupboard. Nobody was watching, but I still felt self-conscious when I reached into the bag and withdrew the John the Conqueror root. There must be some ritual connected with its use. But as I had no idea what that might be, I'd have to roll my own. I paused for a moment, holding the root in the palm of my hand, and thought of the woman who'd given it to him. His great-grandmother, he'd said. So she'd held this root herself, just as I did now. Bless your great-grandson, I said softly, laying the root on his chest, and help him to heal. I didn't know why, but I felt I must stay, and I'd been at this business long enough to know when not to argue with myself. I roused Agnes and sent her upstairs to her bed, then sat down myself in the rocking chair and rocked gently, pressing down with the tips of my stockinged toes. After a time, I stopped and sat listening to the quiet of the room and the breathing of the man and the slow, even beating of my own heart. Dawn's early light roused me from my dozing trance. I got up stiffly and checked my patient, still sleeping, though I could see dreams moving behind his closed eyelids. He was coming gradually to the surface. His skin was cool, though, and the flesh above and below the plaster was firm, no sense of puffiness or crepitation. The fire in the brazier had died to ash, and the air held a moving freshness. "Thank you," I murmured, plucking the conqueror root off Mr. Jackson's chest and restoring it to my amulet. Man's magic could be a useful thing, I thought, given recent events and the prospect of lots more like them. I went out to the privy, then upstairs, where I washed my face, brushed my teeth, changed to a fresh shift, and put my work gown back on. The smell of bacon and fried potatoes was creeping enticingly into the room, and my stomach gurgled in anticipation.
Perhaps there was time to grab a quick bite before Mr. Jackson rejoined the living. Fanny and Agnes were giggling together over a slightly scorched pan of cornbread, but looked up guiltily when I came in.
"I forgot," Fanny said, apologetic, "but then I remembered."
"It will be fine," I said, sniffing it. "Put out butter and a little honey with it, and no one will notice. Have you seen himself this morning?"
"Oh, yes'm," Agnes said. "We went to the surgery a minute ago to see if you were there, or if the soldier wanted breakfast, and Mr. Fraser was there with utensil in his hand. He told us to go make up a plate whilst he talked to Corporal Jackson."
She nodded at a pewter plate on the end of the table, this holding two bannocks with jam, a heap of fried potatoes, and six rashers of bacon.
"I take it," I said, scooping up the plate and taking a fork from the yellow jar on the table.
The metal was warm and the smell divine. "Thank you, girls. Keep the food warm until Mr. Fraser or I come back, will you?" It was very thoughtful of Jamie to call on the corporal with a chamber pot, I thought, amused. That should go some way toward easing his mind. I paused outside the quilt that covered the surgery door, listening to be sure I wouldn't interrupt Mr. Jackson at a delicate moment. The quilt was red side out. I couldn't recall whether I'd pinned it up that way yesterday or not. It was a double-sided quilt that Jamie had brought me in Salem. Two heavy woven wool pieces of cloth, elaborately fastened together with a beautiful quilting stitch that curled into leafy circles and zigzagged down the edges. The red cloth was the colour of old brandy, or blood, as Jamie had observed more than once, and the other side was a deep golden brown dyed with onion skins and saffron. It was my habit to put the quilt up red side out when I was conferring privately with a patient, or doing something embarrassingly intimate to them, as an indication to the household that they ought not to burst in without knocking. I heard a last trickle, a deep sigh from Corporal Jackson, and the metallic scrape of a tin chamber pot sliding across wood, then the noise of Jamie, presumably, sliding it under the counter.
"I thank you, sir," Jackson said, courteous but wary.
"Well, you're no my prisoner," Jamie said in a matter-of-fact tone of voice, "but you do seem to be my guest. As such, of course, you're more than welcome to stay for as long as you like, or need to. But I canna help but think you might have other places you'd rather be, once my wife is pleased with your leg."
Mr. Jackson made a brief sound in which surprise and amusement were mingled in equal proportion, and there was a rustling noise and the creak of my rocking chair as Jamie evidently made himself comfortable.
"I'm most grateful for your hospitality, sir," Jackson said, "and your wife's care of me." "She's a good healer," Jamie said. "You'll do fine. But your leg's broken, so you're no walking out on your own. I'll take you in my wagon where you want to go so soon as Claire says you're fettled."
Jackson seemed a bit taken aback by this, for he didn't answer at once, but made a sort of low humming noise.
"I'm not your prisoner, you say," he said carefully.
"No, I've nae quarrel with you, nor any reason to do you harm."
"You and your men seemed to think otherwise yesterday," the corporal pointed out, a cautious tone in his voice. "Ach, that!"
Jamie was silent for a moment, then asked with no apparent emotion other than mild curiosity,
"Do you ken Captain Stevens intent on calling upon me?"
"No, sir, and I don't wish to know," Jackson said firmly.
Jamie laughed.
"Likely a wise choice. I will na tell you then, save to say it was a personal matter between him and me." "It looked that way."
Was that a hint of humour in Jackson's voice?
I was listening so intently that I'd paid no attention to the food I was holding,
but the scent of bacon at close range was insistently seductive.
"Aye."
The hint of humour was stronger in Jamie's voice.
"I'm figuring he didn't drag the lot of you up here just to make a show of force for me. But there's nothing else within 50 miles of this place. It's nearly 100 miles to the nearest town of any size, save Salem. And neither the Crown nor Captain Stevens would have business with the Moravian brothers and sisters." "You ken them?"
It was a casual question, ostensibly, I thought, and nibbled the crispy end of a rasher. And Jackson answered it likewise.
I've been to Salem once. You're right. Soldiers have no business there. But they have business in the back country, apparently.
Dead silence.
Then I heard the faint squeak of my rocking chair going back and forth, back and forth. Slowly, I swallowed the bacon, feeling a tightness in my throat. For a roving company of British soldiers to have business in a general way, they must have intended one of two things, or possibly both: to rouse loyalists, or to hunt, harass, and discomfit rebels. And a company of black soldiers wouldn't be sent to inspire loyalists to form militias and turn against their neighbours. I glanced involuntarily at the ceiling above me, hearing in memory the crackle of wood and remembering the look of burning timbers about to collapse. But they wouldn't burn this place yet. Ulysses wanted it.
If I was your prisoner, Jackson said at last, slowly, I wouldn't have to answer your questions. Is that right?
I don't know, he added shyly. I haven't been a prisoner before.
I have, Jamie assured him gravely. And aye, that's right. You have to tell your captors your name and rank and the company you belong to, but that's all.
I heard the chair rock forward and Jamie's slight grunt as he rose to his feet.
You didn't even have to tell me that much, as my guest. But as you honoured me with your name and rank, and Captain Stevens told me your company, you're square either way.
I blinked at that. Perhaps he'd meant it casually, but "you're square" was one of the coded phrases Freemasons use to identify one another. I'd heard it frequently in Jamaica when we had enlisted the local lodge to help in our search for young Ian. Were there black Freemasons in this time? Jackson made no reply, though.
But I dinna suppose you want to spend the next several weeks on my wife's table. She'll be needing it sooner or later, Jamie said.
So, his voice was slightly louder. He turned toward the door.
Say where you'd like to go, Corporal, and someone will take you there. In the meantime, let me go and see where your breakfast has got to.
After breakfast and a further brief discussion with Corporal Jackson, Jamie wrote a note and sent Jem up the hill to Captain Cunningham to deliver it. And 2 hours later, Lieutenants Bembridge and Esterhazy appeared at our door. I didn't know what either the captain or Mrs. Cunningham had said to them, but neither one was battered, and when seen, they appeared to be working somewhat uneasily with each other. Just now, they both appeared rather nonplussed and announced that they had come to escort our prisoner, a guest, to the captain's cabin. The captain had agreed, as the leading loyalist on Fraser's Ridge, to offer Corporal Jackson refuge until such time as he could be reunited with his company.
"He can't walk," Jamie advised them. "I'll lend you a mule."
"He can't ride either," I said. "You'll need to make a travois for him." While the men went out to do this, I checked the corporal's condition. Feverish, but not a high fever. A certain amount of pain and some redness. But, I sniffed his leg discreetly, no overt infection. And I wrote up a medical note for Elspeth Cunningham with a description of the injury and notes on care of the plaster cast. I offered him elevenses, which he refused, but he did drink another medicinal posset, involving an egg, cream, sugar, extract of willow bark, black cohosh, and meadow sweet, a good slug of whiskey, and enough laudanum to fell a horse. "You're sure you want to go?" I asked, watching as he sipped the posset. "We're happy to take care of you until you've healed enough to rejoin your company." The corporal was heavy-eyed, and his face was flushed, but he managed to smile.
"It's better I go, madam. This Captain Cunningham, he can send to Captain Stevens. He will make provision for me to go to Charlotte."
I shook my head dubiously. He was doing well enough, but being dragged uphill for 2 miles behind a mule while suffering from a broken leg wasn't anything I'd wish on an enemy, let alone an innocent man. Still, it was his choice.
I took my amulet bag from around my neck and opened it. The usual scent wafted out as I dipped my finger into it, earthy and unidentifiable, but with an odd sense of reassurance. "Well, let me give you back your High John the Conqueror," I said, smiling as I plucked it out. "I hope you won't need it on your journey, but just in case."
"Oh, no, madam."
He waved a slow hand at me, pushing it away.
"Its magic remain with me, because you have healed me with it. But it is part of your magic now."
"Oh, well, thank you, Mr. Jackson. I'll take good care of it." The hard little root was smooth and glossy, and my fingers caressed it briefly as I tucked it back into the amulet and tied the neck. He nodded approvingly, yawned suddenly, and shook his head, then upended the posset cup and drained it. He put out his free hand suddenly, his fingers curling in invitation. I took it automatically, putting a finger on his wrist. Pulse a little fast, but strong, and while his hand was very warm, it wasn't alarming. Then I realized that he was saying something, soft and slurred, but not English.
"I beg your pardon."
"I bless you,"
he said, blinking drowsily. He smiled, and his fingers loosened and slid free. A moment later, he was asleep. When we had seen the Travois party safely off, and the girls and Jem had all gone off on their own errands, Jamie and I returned to the kitchen for a second breakfast. He sat down gingerly, grimacing a little, but shook his head at my inquiring look.
"I'll do. But I'll maybe have a dram with my parritch."
I looked at him narrowly. "Have two," I suggested, and he didn't argue. The big black iron spider was hot in its bed of glowing charcoal, and I laid down several fresh rushes of bacon and broke the last of the eggs from the root cellar, one at a time, into a bowl to check that they were good before I dropped them into the sizzling fat. I could feel the house gradually settling back around us as the sense of intrusion and disruption faded. Still, the inside of my nose prickled at the smoke from the frying bacon, and the remembered smell of fire was sharp in the back of my throat. "What do you think Ulysses will do now?" I asked, setting down the plates. My voice was steady, but my hands weren't. The spoon twitched in my fingers as I shook salt onto the eggs and sent a spray of white crystals over the table. Jamie's eyes were focused on the table, but I thought he hadn't even seen the scattered salt. He'd heard me, though, and after a moment he sat up straight and nodded as though to himself.
"Kill me," he said with a sigh. "Or try to," he added, seeing my face.
The corner of his mouth curled up.
"Dinna fash, Sassenach. I didn't mean to let him."
"Oh, good," I said, and he smiled, though it was a wry one. The bench creaked with his weight as he leaned forward and brushed the spilled salt neatly into the palm of his hand. He tossed a pinch of it over his left shoulder and carefully poured the rest back into the salt cellar. I began to relax enough to feel hungry and picked up my fork.
"If he can somehow make a wee with me, though," he went on dispassionately, taking up the pepper, "he can ride up with his men and turn you and the lassies out and take possession of the place, waving his letter under the noses of the tenants. They wouldna like it, but Cunningham and his men would support him, and while the Lindsays and Macmillans and Bobby are all good fighting men, none of them are what you call leaders. They'd not stand long against trained soldiers and Cunningham's lot, and Ulysses wouldna hesitate to burn them out should he feel the need. He wouldna mind a small war at all."
"Ian and Roger wouldn't stand for that," I said. Jamie cocked a brow at me.
"Ian's a Mohawk, and he'd fight to the death. But he's never commanded men," he pointed out. "Mohawk didna really fight that way. And while a good many of the men on the ridge like him, just as many are that wee bit afraid of him. And liking's not enough to get a man to risk his life and family. As for Roger Mac..."
He smiled a little, ruefully.
"I won't say I've never seen a priest be a bonny fighter, because I have. And Roger Mac can draw folk together and make them listen. But it's no his business to make war, and he hasn't got any experience in doing it. Besides,
He straightened his back and stretched with a muffled popping of vertebrae.
Oh, God. Besides, he repeated,
and gave me a very direct look.
There's no telling when Roger Mack and Bree will be home from Salem. And I dinna ken when Captain Stevens may come back, but come back he will, Sassenach.
I glanced at the window. It was raining again, a speckle of fine droplets. I don't suppose, I said diffidently, that Frank mentioned His Majesty's Company of Black Pioneers in that book.
He did not. Yon bastard was only concerned with the Scots, he said, frowning. I dunna recall one word in that book about black soldiers.
Then his face went blank for a moment, and he made a Scottish noise between disgust and amusement.
Nay, he did say they were black men at the Battle of Savannah. They were from Saint-Domingue, though, with the French Navy.
He made an impatient gesture, dismissing all this complication.
What I do ken is that Stevens will try to kill me if he can, and the sooner the better. And I also ken he'll send someone to fetch his corporal sooner than that.
The kitchen was warm and cosy, but the breakfast congealed in my stomach. I don't think so. Corporal Jackson said that Cunningham would make provision to send him to Charlotte, I blurted. Jamie stared at me for a moment, and I could see the counters falling into place behind his eyes.
Ah,
he said, plainly thinking what I was. Charlotte must be the place where Ulysses planned to rendezvous with the rest of the company of black pioneers.
That will be where Ian's gone, then. He should be back soon, and then...
No, I said. You can't take your militia after him.
I didn't mean to,
he said mildly, and picked up his fork.
It would be good exercise, but the weather's chancy, and the game's beginning to gather and move. The men need to be hunting deer, not British soldiers. Besides, ken what would happen if I caught him, but some of his men got away to tell the tale?
I did, but I let go the breath I'd been holding. He wasn't going to do it. Then a second thought struck me in the solar plexus. I froze for a moment. No, I said, and stood up suddenly, looming over him. No. If you go hunting that man alone, Jamie Fraser, you can't. He blinked. Bluebell jerked out of sleep with a small startled puff, but not seeing anything unusual, she sidled up to Jamie and nosed his leg. He put a hand down to scratch her ears, but kept his gaze on me, considering. Jamie, I said, trying to keep my voice from trembling, if you love me, don't. Please, don't. I can't bear it.
I couldn't. I couldn't bear the thought of his being killed.
But nor could I bear the thought of his hunting, performing execution. The sound of a rifle shot echoed in my head whenever I thought of the man he'd killed, rousing other echoes of that night. A heavy body in the dark, pain and terror and helpless suffocation. And I don't even bloody know if you shot him, I said abruptly, and sat down. The man, whose name I don't know. He looked at me for a moment, head on one side, then reached out delicately and scooped up a bit of yellow with a fingertip. He touched this to my lower lip, and I licked it off by reflex, warm, savoury, delicious.
I love you,
he said softly, and his hand cupped my cheek, big and warm.
As an egg loves salt. Dinna fash, Mochia. I'll think of something else.
Chapter 133. Such an odd feeling. Fraser's Ridge. July the 8th, Anno Domini, 1780. From Captain William C. H. G. Ransom to Mrs. Roger Mackenzie of Fraser's Ridge.
Dear sister, such an odd feeling to write that. My first time of doing it. I haven't much time, I mean, but I have recently been involved in a number of strange circumstances, one of which invoked your name. Or rather, not your name. The fellow only said, I know your sister. Possibly he does. However, I have known this man. His name is Ezekiel Richardson,
over the course of several years, during which he has arguably attempted, on one or more occasions, to kill or abduct me, or otherwise to interfere with my actions. I first knew him as a captain in His Majesty's Army, and much more recently, as a major in the Continental Army. Upon our most recent meeting, near Charlestown, he looked at me oddly and remarked that he knew you. His manner, and indeed his saying such a thing at all, was peculiar in the extreme, and aroused a profound feeling of unease in me. I will not presume to instruct you, as I haven't the vaguest notion as to what advice I should give, but I felt that I must warn you, though against what, I have no idea. With my deepest respect and affection, your brother. Damn, I've never written that before either. William. Postscriptum. Such was my sense of disquiet, I undertook to try to sketch Major Richardson's likeness in case he should seek you out. He has a most undistinguished face. The only distinction I remarked in it is that his ears are placed unevenly, possibly not to the extent in which they appear in this crude sketch, but if he is telling the truth, you may perhaps recognize him should he ride up to your door one day and be on your guard. Brianna's hands had grown sweaty in the reading, and a trickle of perspiration ran down the side of her neck. She knuckled it absently away and wiped her wet hand on her skirt before unfolding the smaller paper. It was a crude sketch, a face-on portrait with the ears comically oversized and attached asymmetrically to the head, like butterflies about to take flight. She smiled for an instant, and then looked closer at the face between those ears. It wasn't distinctive at all, which might have made the drawing better than it otherwise might have been, she thought, frowning. There was simply nothing complicated about the Major's very ordinary face, though she was pleased to see that William did indeed have at least some basic skill in drawing. He'd added a deep chiaroscuro to the left side of the face and quick thumb shading to add hollows beneath the small, clever-looking eyes that... She stopped, something tickling in her brain, and looked closer. Could anyone actually have ears that noticeably off-kilter? Big ears were one thing, but displaced ears? Perhaps if the man had had an accident that severed one ear, and a surgeon had sewed it back on awry? The notion made her smile despite her uneasiness. But another thought was pushing up behind the first, triggered by the thought of surgery. Plastic surgery. She looked again, closer, at that very ordinary face, lacking most of the normal lines of expression. Alarm was flooding through her even before her mind had dotted the I's and crossed the T's. She felt suddenly ill, and sat down abruptly, eyes closed. She hadn't eaten lunch, and now felt nauseated on an empty stomach. Common with morning sickness, her mother had said, but this wasn't morning sickness. She opened her eyes and looked again. And this time she breathed cold air, smelling of pine and heather and burning rubber and hot metal and the acrid ghost of gunpowder. Remembered the hail-like sound of shotgun pellets pattering through gorse and heather, and the warm, greasy feel of an old wool cap in her hand, pulled off the head of a man whose face she hadn't quite seen as he tried to kidnap Jem and Mandy from the dark dooryard of Lallybroch. But now she saw him plain and saw through his disguise. Both of them. Someone will come. She leaned over and threw up. Roger was sitting under a tree on the creek bank, theoretically writing a sermon about the nature of the Holy Trinity, but in actuality hypnotized by the clear brown water gurgling past, letting random quotes about streams and water and eternity roll around inside his skull like rocks being dragged downstream, clacking into each other as they went. "Time is but the stream I go a-fishing in," he murmured, trying it out. He wasn't worried about plagiarizing words that hadn't been written yet. Besides, Davy Caldwell had assured him that quotation was the backbone of many good sermons, and a good place to start if you found yourself without a thought in your head.
which is the case, roughly 9 times out of 10,
Davy had said, reaching for a mug of beer.
And the 10th time you should write your brilliantly original thought down and put it aside, and read it through next day to be sure you're not talking out your ass.
I always thought Ralph Waldo Emerson was talking out his ass, but surely you aren't going to say that in your next sermon, are you?
What?
He looked up from his notebook to see Bree making her careful way down the bank, and his heart lifted at the sight of her. She looked pregnant.
If you live to be 100, I want to live to be 100 minus 1 day, so I never have to live without you, he said.
What? She said, startled. Who said that?
Should I be hurt that you didn't think it was me?
He said, laughing.
It's A.A. Milne, from Winnie the Pooh, if you can believe it.
At this point, she said, and sat down, sighing heavily, I'll believe anything.
Look at this. She handed him an odd-looking drawing of a man's head, the sheet showing the marks of having been folded. My brother sent it to me, she said, and smiled, despite her apparent uneasiness.
He's right. It does feel strange to say it. Brother, I mean.
What is it? Or rather, who?
He could see what it was, a quick sketch of a man's head done in heavy graphite pencil. He frowned at it.
And what's wrong with him?
Well, there's a pair of good questions.
She took a deep breath and settled herself.
That's a drawing of a man named Ezekiel Richardson. William says he's a turncoat, started with the British, switched to the Continentals. He's also some kind of skunk who tried to do William harm of various kinds, but hasn't yet succeeded. Does he look familiar to you?
Roger glanced up at her, puzzled.
No, why should he?
He returned his gaze to the paper and slowly traced the outline of the face.
His ears aren't quite straight. I suppose William doesn't have quite your artistic talent.
She shook her head. No, not that. Try imagining him with longer, curly, sand-coloured hair, light eyebrows, and a sunburn.
Now, slightly alarmed and wondering why, Roger frowned at the portrait of a man with slicked-back dark hair, level dark brows, and small eyes that gave away nothing.
He certainly hasn't got much expression.
Think bad plastic surgery, she suggested, and there was a split second of incomprehension before it hit him. His mouth opened and his throat closed hard, and for an instant he was hanging, falling through a foot of air and ending with a heart-stopping jerk.
Jesus,
he croaked when his throat finally let go its death grip.
A time traveller. You really think so?
I know so, she said flatly. Do you remember when we lived at Lallybroch, a guy named Michael Callahan, he went by Mike, who was an archaeologist who worked on Orkney? He came to look at the Iron Age fort on the hill above the, our, graveyard.
He saw her throat swell as she swallowed hard.
Maybe he wasn't looking at the fort. Maybe he was looking at the graves. And us.
He looked from her tight lips to the drawing back again.
I'm not saying you're wrong,
he said carefully, but...
But I saw him again, she said.
And he saw that she was clutching the fabric of her skirt, bunched in both hands.
At the shootout at the OK Corral.
A surge of searing hot vomit hit the back of his throat and he forced it down. She saw his face and let go the bunched fabric to take his hand in both hers, holding hard.
I wouldn't have thought of it at all, but looking at the ears, and suddenly it just came to me that the only thing I could think of that would make someone's ears be like that would be if they'd had some kind of surgery that didn't quite come out the way it was supposed to.
And the way his face is so blank. And just all of a sudden I remembered that night. He tried to get into the van where the kids and I grabbed the woolly hat off his head and yanked out some of his hair with it, and I caught just a glimpse of his face. And then I didn't think about it again because we were trying to get away, and then I got the kids to California and... But just now... She swallowed again, and he saw that the paleness of her face had given way to a flush of rage. It's him. I know it's him.
Holy buggery,
he said, staring back at the expressionless face, trying to match it to Callahan's mobile, always smiling face. But everything was beginning to fall into place like dominoes paving a path to hell.
He knew Rob Cameron, he said, and Cameron read the book. He knew what we were.
Rob couldn't travel, she said, but maybe Mike Callahan can. And he knew we'd recognize his real face. Chapter 134. F. Cowden, Bookseller. Philadelphia, August the 25th, 1780. It was not out of the ordinary, seen from the street. Not one of the fashionable streets, but not an alley either. The building was red brick, like most of Philadelphia, with fresh white-painted brick facings on the windows and doorway. William paused for a moment to give himself countenance and wipe the sweat from his face while pretending to examine the books displayed in the window. Bibles, of course, but only a large one with an embossed leather cover and gilded pages, and a devotional-sized book of Psalms beside it with a green leather cover bright as a tiny parrot. He instantly revised his original opinion of the bookshop's quality and likely custom, an opinion borne out by the neat array of novels in English, German, and French, including the French translation of Robinson Crusoe, intended for children, from which he'd been taught French at the age of 10 or so. He smiled, momentarily distracted by the warmth of memory, and then glanced up from the display of books to see Amaranthus hovering behind it, no more than her pale face visible through the glass, as though she'd been beheaded. The shock was so great that he gaped stupidly at her for a moment, but he observed that while not gaping stupidly, she appeared at least to be equally taken aback at the sight of him. He drew himself up and fixed her with a stare meant to convey that it was no use her running out of the back door and down the alley, because he was undoubtedly faster than she was and would hunt her down like a fleeing tortoise. She correctly interpreted this look, and her changeable eyes, black in the dimness of the shop, narrowed dangerously.
"Try me,"
he said, out loud, to the startlement of an elderly lady who had stopped beside him to peruse the bookshop's wares.
"I beg your pardon, ma'am," he said, bowing. "Will you have the goodness to excuse me?"
Not waiting for an answer, he pushed open the shop's door and went in. Not surprisingly, Amaranthus was gone. He glanced hastily round the room, which, like every bookshop he'd ever entered, had piles of books stacked on every possible horizontal surface. The place smelled wonderfully of ink and paper and leather, but just this minute he hadn't time to enjoy it. A gnome stepped out from behind the piled desk, leaning on an ebony cane. It was only his height that was gnomish, William saw. He was slender but upright, with a full head of grey hair, thick and worn short, and a darkly tanned, deeply lined face, whose lines were fixed in determination.
"Stay away from my daughter," the gnome said, taking a double-handed grip on his cane, "or I shall—"
His eyes narrowed, and William saw just where Amaranthus had got both eyes and expression. Mr. Cowden, for surely this must be he, looked thoughtfully at William's feet, then allowed his gaze to pass upward to his face, this a foot or so above his own.
"Or I shall break your knee,"
Cowden said, deftly reversing his grip so as to hold the cane in the manner of a cricket bat, and adopting the stance of one intending to smash the ball into the next county. So decided was his manner that William took a step backward. Torn between annoyance and amusement, he bowed briefly.
"Your servant, sir. I am William Ransom."
He'd been about to introduce himself as the Earl of Ellesmere, he realized. He also realized just how much deference that title might be worth, as he wasn't getting any on the strength of his patronym.
"So?"
inquired the gnome, not altering his posture in the slightest degree.
"I've come to deliver a message to your daughter, sir, from His Grace the Duke of Pardlow."
"Pah!"
said Cowden.
Did you say pa?
William inquired, incredulous.
I did, and I propose to go on saying it until you remove yourself from my premises.
I decline to leave until I've spoken with, well, whatever the bloody hell she's calling herself these days. The Viscountess Grey? Mrs. General Bleeker? Or has she gone all the way back to Miss Cowden?
Mr. Cowden's cane swiped within an inch of William's knee, missing only because William's reflexes had carried him backward by a yard. Before the man could swing again, William bent and snatched the cane from his hand. He resisted the urge to break it. It was a fine piece, with a heavy bronze head in the shape of a raven, and instead placed it on the top of the nearest bookshelf, well out of Cowden's reach.
"Now, why do you not wish me to speak to your daughter?" he asked, keeping his tone as reasonable as possible.
"Because she doesn't wish to speak to you," Mr. Cowden replied, his tone slightly less reasonable than William's, but not enraged either. "She said so."
"Ah."
The lack of aggression in William's reply seemed to calm the bookseller slightly. His hair had risen like the crest of a cockatoo, and he made an attempt to smooth it with the palm of his hand. William coughed.
"If she won't talk to me at present, perhaps I could leave her a note," he suggested, gesturing toward an inkwell on the desk.
Cowden seemed dubious.
"I doubt she'll read it."
"I'll lay you 5 to 1 she does."
Mr. Cowden's tongue poked into the side of his cheek, considering.
"Shillings?"
he inquired.
"Guineas."
"Done."
He moved behind the desk, drew out a sheet of paper, and handed William a slender glass pen with a swirling thread of dark blue running up its stem.
"Don't press too hard," he advised. "It's Murano glass and pretty strong, but it is glass. And you're a ham-handed fellow. In terms of size," he amended, "I don't impugn your dexterity, necessarily."
William nodded and dipped the pen gently. "Presumably one used it like a quill." "One did, and it wrote beautifully, smooth as silk and holding its ink very well. No blots, either." He wrote briefly.
"What are you afraid of? Whatever it isn't me. Your most humble and obedient servant, William."
Then sanded the sheet and waved it gently to make sure it was dry. He didn't see any sealing wax, but his father had shown him some years ago how to fold a letter like a Chinese puzzle, in a way that would make it nearly impossible to open and refold the same way. He pressed the creases with his thumbnail to make sure they would show, should the letter be open, before reaching its intended recipient. The bookseller accepted the folded square and raised a thick grey brow.
"Tell her I'll come back tomorrow at 3 o'clock, or without manacles," William said, and bowed. "Your servant, sir."
"Never have daughters,"
Mr. Cowden advised him, tucking the note into a breast pocket.
"They don't listen worth a damn."
William spent a wakeful night between bedbugs, inquisitive moths who seemed intent upon exploring his nostrils, despite these orifices lacking any light whatsoever, and his thoughts, which were undefined but active.
"You go into a situation with an expectation," his Uncle Hal had told him once during a discussion of military tactics. "You should know what you want to happen, even if what you want is no more than your own survival. That expectation will dictate your actions." "Since," his father had neatly interposed, "you might do something different if you only wanted to get out alive than you would if your primary desire was to keep a majority of your troops alive. And something else again if what you wanted was to defeat an opposing commander and damn the cost."
William scratched his middle, meditating.
"Well, so, what do I want to happen?"
On the face of it, he'd already achieved the stated purpose of his expedition, that being to discover where Amaranthus was, and her circumstances and general well-being. Well, fine. She was with her father, which is where she said she was going, and was plainly neither ill nor injured, judging by the speed with which she'd left the premises. What William wanted to know at the moment was whether or not she was wearing her wedding ring. Unfortunately, he couldn't decide what either its presence or its absence might signify. He also couldn't decide which condition he'd personally prefer. Would the sight of her ringless hand fill him with pity, sympathy, satisfaction, or excitement? He felt all those things, imagining it. He couldn't miss it. A thick gold band with an ovoid swelling cut with a deep crease, in which was embedded a large diamond flanked by pearls and tiny beads of Persian turquoise. He yawned, stretched, and relaxed, so far as was possible. The inn's bed was Procrustean for someone of his height, and he was lying with his knees raised, a dark double hillock under the blankets. He'd have to find better quarters if... If what? What indeed? It wasn't in his orders to drag the woman back to Savannah. He needn't hang about in order to try to convince her to go with him. But what about Trevor? Uncle Hal's message, which had been dictated by Lord John, who said that Hal's normal style of correspondence would drive any sane woman to instant flight, made it clear that he regarded her as a daughter, and that she would always find protection and succour under his roof, for herself and her son. Is she sane, I wonder? He was growing sleepy, but felt a distant throb at the thought which had brought her suggestion regarding his personal difficulties to mind. You might, just possibly, enjoy it. He'd rolled sideways, his legs folded up, and now pulled the pillow over his head to muffle the sounds from the bar below, where the singing seemed to be accompanied by someone beating a bass drum. You might too, he murmured, and slept. At 3 o'clock the next afternoon, he presented himself at the bookshop. Mr. Cowden was standing behind his desk, writing in a large ledger. He looked up at William's entrance, regarded him with a beady eye, and then pulled out a shallow drawer from which he removed a single golden guinea and placed it precisely in the centre of the desk. "She's in the courtyard out back," he said, and returned to his accounts. William picked up the guinea, bowed, and went out. The so-called courtyard was a small fenced plot of ground, but had been designed by someone, probably Mr. Cowden, with a fine eye for a garden and a diverse taste in plants. It took William a moment to spot Amaranthus, even though he was looking for her. She was seated on a stone bench in one corner, overhung by a rose trellis, not blooming, but lushly leaved, the foliage tinged with red. A small stone fountain bubbled in front of her. That's why he hadn't seen her at once. She wore black, which didn't become her, and her hair was pinned up under a cap with a tiny bit of lace edging. She still wore her wedding ring, and he felt a small twinge of what might be disappointment. Then he saw that while she still wore the ring, she'd changed it from her left hand to her right. He stopped just by the fountain and bowed to her.
"So you're not afraid of anything now?"
She looked him over, soberly, then lifted her eyes to meet his, pale blue, translucent. "I wouldn't say that. But I'm certainly not afraid of you." It might have been a challenge or a sneer, but it wasn't. It was just a statement of fact, and rather warmed him.
"Good," he said. "Why did you run when I came yesterday, then?"
"I panicked," she said frankly. "I'd put away all thought of Father Pardlow and Lord John and Savannah."
"And me?"
"And you," she said evenly. "And after a bit it all began to seem unreal. Like the sort of fantasy you have when you're reading a good book. So when you popped up like the demon king in a pantomime..." She flicked a hand. After a moment's pause, she asked, "Do you want to sit down?" He sat beside her, close enough to feel the warmth of her. It was a small bench, and William was a large young man. He wasn't sure quite what to ask yet.
"You're a widow, then?"
he said at last, and picked up her hand, examining the ring. "Yes, I am," she said coldly.
"Really? Or only so far as your father and Philadelphia know?"
She gave him a narrow look, but she didn't pull her hand away, and she didn't reply at once, either.
"Because," he said, stroking the back of her hand with his thumb, "if Ben's really dead now, you haven't any reason for not coming back to Savannah with me, do you? Don't you want to see Trevor? He misses his mama."
"You bastard," she hissed. "Let go."
He did, folding his hands on his knees. There was no sound for several minutes, save the rattle and hum of traffic in the street and the plash of the fountain. The smell of the garden was strong in the air, and while it was by no means as lush as the southern scents of Savannah, it was pungent enough to stir the blood, and memories of Mrs. Fleury's garden, with its cold, wet stone, and the silent witness of a black-eyed toad.
"I'm the only one you can tell," he said at last, quietly. "I don't expect your father knows, does he, what happened to Ben?"
She laughed, short and bitter, but a laugh.
"What happened to Ben?" she repeated. "Not what Ben did?"
"General Washington didn't come and kidnap him, you know. He went.
He did it all by himself."
"You went to him, though, didn't you?"
This wasn't entirely a guess. He'd seen that her fingers weren't shadowed with ink. Everyone who worked in a print shop or a bookseller's eventually had smudged fingers. Her father did. If hers weren't, she hadn't been here long. She didn't answer at once, but sat silently fuming, mouth pressed tight.
"I did," she said at last.
"The more fool I.
I thought I could talk him round. I seen what happened during the siege in Savannah. I thought I could convince him. For God's sake, he was a British officer. He should know what the army's like, what they can do."
"I suppose he does," William said mildly. "Rather courageous of him to go take up arms against them, isn't it?"
She made a noise like an angry cat and flounced away from him.
"So he wouldn't come back to Savannah with you? Why didn't you just go yourself? You know the Greys would welcome you with open arms, if only because you'd take Trev off their hands."
She breathed hard through her nose, then suddenly flounced back round to face him.
"I did see Ben.
I saw him in bed with a black-haired whore who was sucking his..." Collar choked her as efficiently as Ben had likely choked his inamorata when he saw Amaranthus looming in the doorway. William hesitated to say anything for fear of making her leap up and run inside. Instead, he placed his hand on the bench between them, barely touching her fingers, and waited. "He got up and pushed me into his dressing room, and kept me from going back into the bedroom until she'd got up and run, the filthy twat."
"Where the devil did you learn a word like that?" he asked, truly shocked.
"A book of erotic poetry in Lord John's library," she said, glaring at him. "I would have killed both of them right there if I'd had any bloody thing to do with it. You don't go to a reunion with your estranged husband with a knife in your shoe, though, do you?"
She stared down at her naked left hand. "I yanked my ring off and tried to make him swallow it."
"I almost managed, too," she said defiant.
There were tears of rage slicked down her cheeks, but she didn't seem aware of them.
"I'm sorry you didn't," he said,
and took a careful breath.
"I don't excuse Ben by any means, but he's a soldier, and he thought you'd left him forever. I mean, casual liaison."
"Casual my ass," she snarled, snatching her hand away. "He's married her."
The words struck him in the pit of the stomach. William opened his mouth, but found nothing whatever to say.
"That's why I brought the ring away with me," she said, looking at it. "I wouldn't let her have it."
Of course, she'd also needed it for her widow's imposture, but he rather thought that continuing to wear it, even if on her right hand, might be something in the nature of a hair shirt for her, but didn't say that. "Marry me," he said instead.
She was frowning at a bird that had landed on the edge of the fountain to drink, a dressy little creature with black and white wings and dark red sides. "Toey," she said.
"What?"
"Him." She lifted her chin toward the bird, who promptly flew off. She turned on the bench to look William full in the face, her own features more or less composed. "Marry you," she said slowly. A twitch she couldn't control showed briefly at the corner of her pale mouth, but he didn't think it was an impulse to laugh. Maybe shock, maybe not. "Marry me," he said again softly. Her eyes were bloodshot, and now a cloudy grey. She looked away. "You mean a mariage blanc, I suppose," she said, her voice a little hoarse. "Separate lives, separate beds." "Oh, no," he said, and took hold of both her hands. "I definitely want to bed you. Repeatedly."
"What sort of marriage do you call that?"
"Well, bigamy for a start." She was looking at him in a different way, though, and the blood was thrumming in his chest.
"We can discuss the details on the way back to Savannah."
Still holding her hands tightly in his, he leaned down and kissed her. Her mouth moved under his, more in shock than response, but response it was.
"I did not say I'd do it," she said, jerking back.
He let her go, noting with a distant satisfaction that she hadn't wiped her mouth in disgust.
"You can give me your answer when we get to Savannah," he said,
and getting to his feet, he offered her his hand. Chapter 135.
Just to make things interesting.
In a small town to the south of Philadelphia, he'd hired them rooms in a decent inn and was pleased to find a small looking-glass on the wall above his washbasin. He'd shaved carefully. Amaranthus had been first shocked and then amused by the discovery that his sprouting beard was a vivid dark red, and then dressed in his captain's uniform, somewhat creased from being rolled up in his portmanteau, but clean. She blinked when he got into the coach beside her and placed his hat on his knee. "I thought you'd resigned your commission."
"I did. I have. This is what you might call a rousse de guerre," he said, gesturing at his scarlet coat. "Uncle Hal's idea. He gave me a temporary captain's commission with orders for travel that would let me pass through any territory controlled by the king's troops, which Richmond and Charlestown most assuredly are."
"I wasn't joking," he added gently. "He was worried about you, and he does want you back." She glanced away, out the window, and bit her lip.
"I should have thought an earl would be shown a certain amount of courtesy even without a uniform." "I'm not an earl either," he said firmly,
and her head swiveled sharply round. She stared at him.
"I should have said before," he said. "If you were considering being a countess as part of the perquisites of marrying me, I'm afraid that's off."
"I wasn't," she said, and her mouth twitched slightly. She turned back to the window through which the muddy streets of Richmond were giving way to equally rain-soaked cornfields. "How did you manage it?" she said, not turning round. "I thought Father Pardlow told you a peer couldn't stop being a peer without the permission of the king. Did you persuade the king?"
"I haven't spoken to his majesty yet," William said politely, "but I shall." "Still, it doesn't matter what he says. I've made up my mind, and I'm not the Earl of Ellesmere any more. If ever I was."
That did make her turn around. He felt a sudden rush of something, maybe fear, but mostly excitement, as though he were just about to jump from a high cliff into the sea, not knowing if the water was deep enough, and not caring.
"I'm a bastard," he said.
It wasn't the first time he'd said it, and he felt sure it wouldn't be the last, but he took a deep breath before going on.
"I mean, I'm not legally a bastard, because the 8th Earl and my mother were married when I was born, but the old Earl wasn't my father.
She looked him slowly up and down, pausing at his face, her gaze travelling down and up again.
Well, whoever he was, he must have been, very striking gentleman. Is that where...
She pawed vaguely at her chin, still staring at him.
Yes, he said, not quite between his teeth. And not was.
He's still alive.
You've met him?
She'd turned entirely to face him, her eyes alive with interest. He had the sudden illusion that he could feel the touch of her eyes on his face tickling his skin.
I have. He knows me. And that I know about him.
She didn't say anything for a bit, but he could see her turning this revelation over in her mind. She still wore black, but had taken to wearing a fichu of dark blue with it, rather than white. It made her eyes brilliant and warmed her skin. Plainly she knew it, and he hid a smile. She saw it nonetheless and leaned back, pursing her lips.
Do you mean to tell me who this gentleman is?
I hadn't, he admitted. But if you're to marry me...
I am not accepting your proposal.
Not now.
Probably not ever, she added, giving him a look. But even if I don't, you should know that I wouldn't tell anyone.
Good of you, he said.
His name is James Fraser, a Highland Scot and a Jacobite,
or was, I should say.
He has some land in North Carolina.
I visited there when I was quite young. Didn't have the slightest clue that he was what he is.
He's acknowledged you. Amaranthus had never been one to hide what she thought, and the direction of her thoughts just now was easy to make out.
No, and I don't want him to, William said firmly. He owes me nothing.
Though if you're wondering how I shall support you without the Ellesmere estates, he added, don't worry. I have a decent small farm in Virginia that my mother, well, my stepmother, really, Lord John's first wife, left me.
There was Hellwater as well, but he thought that might disappear along with Ellesmere, so didn't mention it.
Lord John's first wife? Amarantha stared at him. I hadn't thought he'd been married at all. How many wives has he had?
Well, two that I know of.
He hesitated. But in fact he rather enjoyed shocking her.
His second wife was, well, she still is, the wife of James Fraser, just to make things interesting.
She narrowed her eyes, looking to see if he was making game of her, but then shook her head, dislodging a hairpin that poked suddenly out of her hair. He couldn't resist plucking it out and tucking the liberated curl behind her ear. A faint stipple of goose flesh ran down the side of her neck, and she shuddered ever so faintly, despite the humid heat inside the carriage.
2 weeks later.
Emergence from the coach was like hatching out of a chrysalis, he thought, stretching his long folded legs and his aching back before reaching to help Amaranthus out of their travelling womb. Air, sunlight, and above all, space. He yawned uncontrollably, and air flooded into him, inflating him back to his proper dimensions. He'd intended to take Amaranthus back to Uncle Hal's quarters, and hesitated for a moment, but she said firmly that she'd rather go to Lord John's house first.
I trust Uncle John to listen, she'd said, and fond as I am of Father Pardlow.
Why are you looking like that? I am fond of him.
I'm just never sure what he'll do about things.
And Ben's his son, after all. Good point, William admitted. Mind, I doubt my father knows what Hal will do either. But he's used to dealing with the effects, at least.
Exactly, she'd said,
and spoke no more on the drive through the city, only glancing at her reflection in the coach's window, and touching her hair now and then. The door of number 12 Oglethorpe Street opened before he could knock, his first inkling that something was wrong.
Oh, you found her. Miss Crabb was looking over his shoulder at Amaranthus, her lean face shifting between pleased relief and a desire to stay irritated. The baby's asleep. His Grace has gone to Charlestown, the housekeeper added, stepping back to let them in. He thought he'd be back within 2 weeks, but sent a letter that came 2 days ago that he was detained at my Lord Cornwallis's pleasure.
Amaranthus had disappeared up the stairs in search of Trevor, so this explanation was delivered to William.
I see, he said, stepping inside. Did my father go with his grace?
It was evident that Lord John wasn't in the house, because if he had been, he'd be present right now. Miss Crabbe's abiding expression of discontent had shifted, showing something of uneasiness.
No, my lord, she said.
He went out day before yesterday, and he hasn't come back.
Chapter 136. 2 days previously. The note had arrived at number 12 Oglethorpe Street just after luncheon. It had been a casual meal, ham sandwiches and a bottle of beer, consumed in the cookhouse while Lord John watched Moira dealing with an enormous turbot that had been delivered that morning. The woman knew how to wield a cleaver, he thought, despite her recalcitrant attitude toward tomatoes. A pity. She was plainly capable of turning any tomato into an instant ketchup with one blow. He watched with keen anticipation as she squinted at the fish. It was so large that it hung off the sides of the small table, deciding upon the direction of her next attack. Before she could strike, though, a shadow fell through the open door of the cookhouse, and there was a brief knock upon its jamb.
Mein Herr.
It was Gunther, an ostler from the livery stables Hal patronized, obsequious in his leather apron.
Ja, was ist das?
Grey asked. He saw Moira blink, momentarily suspend her next thwack, and swivel her head from him to Gunther and back, squinting suspiciously. Gunther shrugged, raising his brows in abnegation of responsibility, and handed over a neatly folded note, sealed with candle wax, and waved a hand over his shoulder to indicate that someone at the livery had given it to him. Grey fumbled in his pocket for a coin, came out with a penny and a shilling, handed over the shilling, and took the note with a brief word of thanks. He'd thought at first that it was something for Hal, but the note was addressed to Lord John Grey, in a neat secretarial style, quite at odds with the note's casually obscure delivery. The message inside was in the same hand, but just as puzzling as the exterior.
My lord, I'm told that you once employed a man by the name of Thomas Bird. This man took passage from England upon my ship, the Pallas, and paid for his passage upon embarkation. However, he has formed an attachment to a young person he met aboard, and this young person did not pay for her passage, having instead stowed away in the hold. Mr. Bird says he will pay for her passage to avoid her being taken up by the sheriff and jailed, but does not possess ready cash for this purpose. Being reluctant to commit such a comely young woman to the local prison, I asked whether Mr. Bird might have friends who would bear his expenses. He demurred, not wishing to presume upon his acquaintance. But I had heard him mention your name whilst on board, and so I take the liberty of informing you of his circumstances. Should you wish to assist Mr. Bird, or at least to speak with him, he is still aboard us. Pallas is docked at the easternmost warehouse quay. Your most humble and obedient servant, sir, John Doyle, Captain.
How very peculiar, Grey said, turning the paper over as though the back might be more informative.
Oh, it isn't peculiar, sir, Moira assured him, wiping a hand across her sweating brow. It's only a female.
What?
Female, she repeated, gesturing at the decapitated fish. It's females what has eggs, what's called roe.
Oh. He saw that she had not only removed the head, tails and fins, opened the great flat body and shovelled out the guts, but had also reserved a large, solid mass of some dark substance, presumably fish eggs, this oozing oil onto a plate that had been set aside on a shelf, there being no room for it on the scale-encrusted surface, where the fish itself was being transformed into dinner.
Quite, he said. Might we have some with eggs, do you think?
Just what I had in mind, me lord, she assured him. Fresh toast soldiers with poached eggs and roe, with a bit of melted butter to pour over. What is Grace calls a horse d'oeuvre.
splendid, he said with a smile. I'll be home for supper in good time.
Had it not been for this dark obtrusion of femininity, he might not have gone. But the mention of females had reminded him of Tom's marked susceptibility to young women, something that had, so far as he knew, been held in strict abeyance during his two marriages. But his last letter from Tom, who wrote infrequently but well, had told him that Tom's second wife had recently died, and as his eldest boy was now 18, he had it in mind to leave young Barney in charge of the business for a bit, and perhaps undertake a journey to Germany. He, not having visited there since their early acquaintance with the Graf von Nansen, and he begged that Lord John would be so kind as to extend his regards to the Graf, when Lord John might be in communication with the same. He supposed it was at least possible that Tom, embarked on a personal voyage of discovery, might have been inspired to leave Europe altogether, and that in doing so, still in the throes of grief, he might well have been drawn to a young woman in obviously dire straits. Tom was a gallant man, and a very kind one. On the other hand, this letter had a distinct smell of fish, and it wasn't turbot. He folded it thoughtfully and tucked it into his waistcoat pocket. "What the hell?" he said aloud, startling Moira in mid-chop. "Oh, I beg your pardon, Mrs. O'Meara. I meant only that it's a pleasant day for a walk." It was a pleasant day, with a breeze stirring the heavy summer air, and he enjoyed the stroll down to Bay Street, where he stopped to climb down the steps and walk barefoot on the sandy beach for a bit, before resuming a casual peregrination toward the warehouse district. The produce fleet, fishermen and farmers bringing fruit and vegetables from upriver, consisted mostly of small boats, and thus docks near to Bay Street tended to be narrow and close together. The docks owned by the warehouses, though, were stout, wide affairs down which barrows could be driven, barrels rolled, and crates hauled with minimal danger of falling into the water. The big ships that sailed foreign seas anchored either by the warehouse docks or out in the river if there was a great deal of ship traffic. There was a great deal of such traffic at the moment, and Gray stopped to admire it, a beautiful sight with tall masts swaying and sun glinting off the wings of the seabirds circling the ships. He liked ships of all sorts, though the sight of them always made him think of one James Fraser, who disliked ships to the point of nearly dying of seasickness every time he went aboard one. He smiled, the memory of an eventful channel crossing with a Scotsman many years ago being now distant enough as to be entertaining. He kept away from the easternmost dock, not being a complete fool. He bought some apples from a cellar on one of the smaller docks, taking the opportunity to look over at the larger ships. "What's that Indiaman anchored out in the channel?" he asked the apple seller, gesturing briefly at a large ship clearly capable of crossing the Atlantic. It was flying no flag he recognised, though. "Oh," she said, having glanced indifferently over her shoulder. "Castle, it's called. Nope. I'll tell a lie. It's Palace. That's it." Well, that was one fact noted. A ship named Palace did exist and was an Atlantic sailor. Whether Tom Bird was or ever had been aboard her was another question, but...
"Sir? Sir?"
The repetition jerked from his thoughts to see a runty sailor with a rusty beard before him.
"There's summat on your hat, sir," he said, pointing upward.
Seagulls instantly in mind, Gray clapped a hand over his head, then seized the hat and brought it down for inspection. Suddenly, his vision went dark, and something light tickled his face. Then something exploded in his head, and everything went dark. He came round with a sharp ache in the back of his head and a strong urge to vomit. He attempted to roll onto his side in order to do so, but discovered that his arms were bound to his sides. There was also a burlap sack over his head, and this decided him not to vomit, even though a dizzy sense of being rocked back and forth made the urge to do so still more urgent.
"Shit, it's a boat."
Now he heard the splash of oars and the grunt of whoever was wielding them, and smelled the fecund scent of the distant marshes. It wasn't a big boat. He'd been doubled up and stuffed into a small space between the seats. His knees were wet. Before he could congratulate himself on the acuity of his suspicions or berate himself for stupidity in not paying sufficient attention to them, the sound of oars ceased, and the next moment the boat came to a stop with a thump that jarred his throbbing head. More rocking, and strong hands seized him and stood him up. A shout from whoever was holding him, and a rope dropped from above, hitting his shoulder. The kidnapper, was there only one, wrapped this round his middle and knotted it, then shouted, "Heave away!" And he was jerked into the air and hauled up like a side of beef. Hans pulled him aboard and stood him up again, but he had no balance with his arms bound, and fell to his knees. The sack was jerked off his head, and the stab of sunlight into his eyes was too much. He threw up on the shoes of the man who stood before him, then collapsed gently onto his side and closed his eyes in hopes of finding equilibrium. There was a certain amount of cursing and colloquy going on above him, but at the moment he didn't care, as long as none of it resulted in his being obliged to stand up again. Then he heard a voice he recognized.
"For God's sake, untie him," it said impatiently. "What happened to him?"
He cracked one eyelid open. His ears had not betrayed him, but his eyes had their doubts. Everything overhead appeared in motion. Masts, sails, clouds, sun, faces were all swirling in a dizzying fashion that made him want to vomit again.
"Someone hit me on the head,"
he said, closing one eye in hopes of stopping the maypole dance. Rather surprisingly, it did. And the blandly good-looking face of Ezekiel Richardson wavered into focus.
"My apologies," Richardson said,
and reaching down, pulled him to his feet and held him by the elbows while someone undid the ropes.
"I told them to bring you, but I didn't think to specify the means. Come below and sit down. I imagine you could use a drink."
He rinsed his mouth with brandy and spat into a bowl, then sat back and sipped a little, cautiously. They sat in what was plainly the captain's great cabin, for the stern windows rose in a blaze of scintillant light reflected from the river below. It made him queasy to look at it for more than a few seconds, but he was beginning to feel better.
"I really do apologize," Richardson said,
and it sounded as though he meant it.
"I have no personal animus against you at all. And if I could have managed this without involving you, I would have."
Gray shifted his gaze reluctantly to Richardson, who wore the uniform of a British infantry major.
"I have heard of double agents, and met them too," he said more or less politely. "But damned if I've seen one less able to make up his mind. Would you care to tell me which side you're really on?"
He thought the expression on Richardson's face was meant to be a smile, but it wasn't altogether succeeding.
"That," Richardson said, "is not as simple a question as you might think." "Well, it's as good a question as you're likely to get, under the circumstances."
Gray closed his eyes and lifted the glass under his nose. Maybe inhaling brandy fumes would allay the headache without making him drunk. He thought it might be dangerous to be drunk in Richardson's company.
"Let me ask you one, then."
Richardson was sitting in the captain's chair. It creaked as he leaned forward.
"When I asked you whether you had any personal interest in Claire Fraser, you replied that you didn't, and then promptly married her. Why did you do that?"
That made John open his eyes. Richardson had spoken mildly, but was regarding him with the air of a very patient cat sat outside a mouse hole. John touched the back of his head gingerly, then looked at his fingers. Yes, he was bleeding, but not heavily.
"I could tell you that it's none of your business,"
he said, wiping his fingers on his breeches.
"But as it is, there's no reason for secrecy. You had threatened to have the lady arrested for sedition. She was the widow of a good friend.
It seemed to me that keeping her out of your clutches was perhaps the last office I could perform for Jamie Fraser.
Richardson nodded.
Just so, he said. A gallant gesture, my lord.
He seemed slightly amused, though it was hard to tell.
I understand that the marriage was necessarily of short duration, owing to Mr. Fraser's unexpected return from a watery grave. But did the lady tell you, in some exchange of marital confidences, anything regarding her antecedents?
No, Gray said, without hesitation.
That seems rather remarkable, Richardson said. Though, given what those antecedents are, perhaps the lady's reticence was justified.
A ripple of unease crept down the back of Gray's neck.
Or perhaps it was just a dribble of blood, he thought. Antecedents, my ass.
He leaned back a little, careful of his tender head, and gave Richardson what he hoped was an inscrutable stare. Richardson regarded him for a long moment, then, with a brief nod to himself, rose and fetched a leather folder from the shelf and sat down again. He opened the folder and removed an official-looking document, complete with seal and stamp, though Gray couldn't tell from where he sat whose seal it was.
"Are you familiar with a man named Neil Stapleton?" Richardson asked, cocking one brow.
"In what sense, familiar?"
Gray asked, raising both of his. "I might have heard the name, but if so, it's been some time."
It had been some time, but the name Neil Stapleton, better known to Gray as Neil the Cunt, had struck him in the pit of the stomach with the force of a 2-pound round shot. He hadn't seen Stapleton in many years, but he certainly hadn't forgot the man.
"Perhaps I should have inquired as to whether you knew him in the biblical sense?"
Richardson asked, watching Gray's face. He pushed the document toward Gray, whose eyes fixed at once on the heading, "Confession of Neil Patrick Stapleton."
"No," he thought. "Bloody hell, no."
He took up the document, glad in a remote way to see that his hands weren't shaking, and read a moderately detailed and quite accurate account of what had occurred between himself and Neil Stapleton on the night of April the 14th, 1759, and again on the afternoon of May the 9th of the same year. He laid down the document and stared at Richardson over it.
"What did you do to him?" he asked.
His stomach tightened at the thought of what they, for surely it was a they, and not this man alone, might have done to a man like Neil.
"Do to him?" Richardson said, looking bland. "Blackmail, bribery, torture. He didn't write this of his own free will. What sane man would?"
And whatever else he might be, Neil had never been lacking in his wits. Richardson shrugged.
"Is he alive?" Gray said, between his teeth.
"Do you care?"
Richardson seemed only faintly amused. "Oh, but of course you do. If he were dead, you could claim that this document is a forgery. But I'm afraid that Mr. Stapleton is, in fact, still alive. Though I naturally cannot guess as to how long he'll stay in that condition."
Gray stared at him. Was the fellow actually now threatening to have Neil killed? But that made no sense.
"He is, however, in London. Fortunately, though, I have additional testimony, shall we say, nearer to hand.